I think most of us have an idea or a concept of religion. Most of the time we don't think too much about that. You know, religion, you know, what does it mean in our lives? For our topic today, I'd like to delve in some definitions of the word religion. And here's from the freedictionary.com. I almost have that on, not speed dial, but I have it on my list on my computer, and I use it all the time. But here's a few basic definitions. Number one, and it has a few subpoints. Number one, religion is the belief in and reverence for supernatural power or powers regarding as creating and governing the universe. This is actually, I didn't know this, but it's actually from via the French. It's a Latin word that means fear of the supernatural. I heard an off-the-cuff definition one time that says, well, religion is basically humankind's response to God. And maybe that's out of that fear, the supernatural. I'm not sure. Okay, that was A. That was subpoint A. Subpoint B, religion is a particular variety of beliefs, especially when organized into a system of doctrine and practice. And that kind of broadly describes the religions of the world. And subpoint C, religion is a set of beliefs, values, and practices based on the teaching of a spiritual leader. Ouch. That could include cults. You know, you think of some of the cults in our, that could be a religion. Okay, the definition number two, the life or condition of a person in a religious order, that is one that has religion. And three, the last one, a cause, principle, or activity pursued with zeal or conscientious devotion. In other words, anything can become a religion to a person. You know, Tim and I could say golf is religion. We practice. Those are just some of the basic definitions, and I think we all understand those. But if you want to dig further into that, you can Google anything, and you can search until you're exhausted, till you fall out of your chair or whatever, looking for these things. But you know, academia, science, they all have their versions, their definitions of religion too. And you know, frankly, I wouldn't advise going there. It's endless. But what we're interested in today is what the Bible has to say about the concept of religion. Let's turn over to James, Epistle of James, James chapter 1. James chapter 1, and we'll go down to verses 26 and 27. And I'll be reading this out of the New King James. James 1, verse 26. If anyone among you thinks he's religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. I like the NLT. It says this one's religion is worthless. So James says it's possible to have a worthless religion. That's what he's telling us here. According to the definitions we covered, you know, we might have the correct set of beliefs. We might, you know, concerning the cause and the creation and everything in the universe, we might even know God's name. We might have all that right. But James said our religion could still be worthless, because in verse 27 it says something else. It says, verse 27 of James said, pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Now, that word religion is only used a few times in scriptures, but it's referring to worshiping God. You know, that's kind of self-explanatory. But I want to home in on that phrase there, pure and undefiled. Because if there's a pure religion, which just means worshiping God, there's also a defiled or an impure religion. Again, worshiping God in a defiled, impure way. In essence, the Bible describes those two religions. Hence the title, Two Religions. I like to keep my title simple. Kind of goes with my intelligence, maybe. But I'd like to look at each one of those in turn today via 3 points each. First, let's look at the defiled or impure religion the Bible talks about. It does discuss that in 3 points. You know, one of the foundational principles that we learned through Jesus was to look at the fruits of something. So, you know, so in these points, we'll examine what impure religion looks like and what pure religion looks like. But the impure first. In other words, what they look like in practice. The characteristics of each one. We're going to examine those characteristics. So let's start with the characteristic of an impure religion. And the first characteristic, again, 3 points under each one of these. The first characteristic, I'll get it out, untwist my tongue, of an impure religion is it emphasizes and serves tradition and not people. It serves tradition and not people. Let's turn over to Matthew 15. And I'll be using in Matthew 15, actually we're going to read verses 1 through 20, and I'll be using the NLT. I know the NLT is a paraphrase, but it's an accurate one. There's only a few places I found where kind of an oops. Okay, in Matthew 15, familiar section to all of us, but beginning in verse 1. Some Pharisees and teachers of religious law now arrive from Jerusalem to see Jesus. They ask him, "Why do your disciples disobey our age-old tradition? For they ignore our tradition of ceremonial hand-washing before they eat." So there was a tradition taught by the Pharisees that they enforced upon the Jewish people. Before they ate, they had to wash their hands. That was the rule. That was the tradition. And, you know, that had nothing to do with cleanliness or hygiene. It really didn't. But it had to do with a tradition, as we'll see later, went clear back to the ancient Israelite, to the priesthood. The word tradition, the word is Strong 3862, and just a reference from the Word Study Dictionary. The dictionary says it's used about 13 times, and the tradition is used some 13 times in the New Testament. I won't try to pronounce it. It's not really important to the subject. But it's a noun, means to deliver in teaching. It means a tradition can mean a doctrine or injunction, this is their words, delivered or communicated from one to another, whether divine or human. In no need to turn there, but a couple of references, Mark 7, verse 3 and 7, verse 5, there's an expression you'll see, the tradition of the elders. Not their words, but mine, you know, the tradition of the elders is what the Jews believed, basically starting with the priesthood, the law of Moses, that there, when the law was given, he also whispered an oral tradition. So that, anyhow, but continuing, they're proud of the word study. The Pharisees delivered to the people by tradition, their ancestors, many injunctions which were not written in the law of Moses. For this reason, the sect of the Sadducees rejected them, saying that what was written should be esteemed obligatory, but that which came from oral tradition need not be observed. There's a conflict. We can read of that in the New Testament. Thus, Josephus explains the expression, the tradition of the elders, or of the Pharisees, really. The words of the elders were considered more desirable than the words of the prophets. That's end quote. Basically, it was their system of beliefs. And some synonyms that go along with that, and these are familiar too. It could also mean dogma, and it could mean custom. You know, we have customs. And obviously, there's good and bad traditions. I think we all know that. But in a sense here, they're not a good tradition. We have a good tradition. Thanksgiving is coming up. Our tradition is get their whole big family together and have a really good time. In regard to these traditions, in Matthew 23, we'll see later, Jesus said the scribes and the Pharisees via these traditions laid heavy burdens on men's shoulders. They're unbiblical. These were the traditions that were passed along verbally, and finally written down in the Mishnah, which the Jews considered the oral Torah. That's what they considered it. It's not true. But going on here, so the again, back to this tradition, the disciples had to wash their hands, they thought. But the Jesus' disciples did not do that. And I believe what Jesus is going to say here, that a true religion is not about tradition. It's about helping people when it comes to overriding established traditions. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes we have to choose between a conflict, between an established tradition and just serving, helping people. That's just a fact. Verse 3, Jesus goes on here. Jesus replied, "And why do you, by your tradition, violate the direct commandments of God?" Which is what they did. You know, when you think about the traditions they had a whole layer of traditions that they laid on people. That's the heavy burdens that they laid on men's shoulders. Basically, what Jesus is saying here, they smothered God's true commandments with their tradition. They did that. You know, if you want to look if you want to research, sometimes I like to research, sometimes I don't have the time. But if you want to look that up, the Pharisees had something like 39 categories of traditions just laid on the Sabbath. Talk about a layer of traditions. For example, thrashing. And here's just a few samples of the 39 categories. There was a tradition concerning threshing. You weren't allowed to thresh anything on the Sabbath for food. And that includes squeezing orange juice, whatever it might be. You weren't allowed to do that. Harvesting. You weren't allowed to harvest anything. You couldn't go pick an orange or an apple off of a tree, or pick an olive. You couldn't do that. And what if you had chickens? You can't go out and collect an egg. Selecting, there was a category of selecting. This is kind of a humorous one. Marie can probably relate to this, but what this means is selecting is if you had a dish in front of you and you had meat and broccoli or peas or, something like that, you couldn't separate those. And Marie knows that I do that all. I violate that tradition all the time. But this was a rule. You couldn't do that. You had to eat everything. You couldn't separate it. You had to eat it all together. I can't stand that myself. Sifting. You weren't allowed to sift flour, anything else. If you had orange juice or tomato juice or something like that, you had to eat the pulp with that. You could not sift that pulp out of there. You had to eat that. So, in last part of verse 3 there where Jesus said, you violate the commandments of God. In the last part of the verse 3 there says, for the sake of your tradition, they laid all this on people. And this is just a sample. They had dozens of them. And Jesus goes on with an example here. He cites the fifth commandment in verse 4. For instance, Jesus said, God says, honor your father and mother, and anyone who speaks disrespectfully of father and mother must be put to death. But you say it is all right for people to say to their parents, sorry, I can't help you, for I vowed to give to God what I would have given to you. I want to take care of that first before I take care of you, mom and dad. In this way, verse 6, you say they don't need to honor their parents, and so you cancel the word of God for the sake of your own tradition. They threw that commandment out for the sake of tradition. That's what he's saying. It's pretty scathing criticism that he's laying on them here. Verse 7, it goes on to say, you hypocrites, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you, for he wrote, and he's citing Isaiah 29, verse 13, these people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. You know, they had stony hearts. They were all bound up in these traditions. Verse 9, their worship or religion is a farce, for they teach man-made ideas, there are many traditions, as if commands from God. Then Jesus called to the crowd to come and hear, and he said, listen and try to understand. It's not what goes into your mouth that defiles you. You're defiled by the words that come out of your mouth. And Jesus was telling them, the crowd, and the Pharisees too, there's more important things than tradition. Sometimes we have to break out of tradition, to follow God's law, to serve people, to have a pure religion, actually. And of course, the Pharisees were always worried about that tradition, what it looked like and to others, and it was an end to them, their tradition. And it doesn't take much reach here to, you know, that we have whole belief system, and I won't mention the denominations and all that. They're all based on tradition. It's all tradition. There's no fact there. There's no truth there. Even historically, we had one particular tradition, didn't we? We believed that Christ was the God of the Old Testament. That was a tradition. That was simply wasn't true. We didn't understand it at the time. We understand it now, thankfully. You know, it doesn't make us special. We're just happy now that we understand it. Second point under an impure religion is that impure religion enslaves people for its own benefit. It enslaves people for its own benefit. Let's turn over to Matthew 23, a very familiar chapter. Matthew 23. Again, from the New King James. Matthew 23, beginning in verse 1. Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. But do not do according to their works, for they say and they do not do. For they bind heavy burdens," there it is, "hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their little fingers." You know, they create rules and regulations for other people. You know, most religions call the lay people the common people, you know. But they themselves here would not, these things don't apply to them. They apply to everyone else but them. Verse 5, "But all their works they do to be," what? "Seen by men. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the bottom," I'm sorry, "the borders of their garments." Actually, they are the bottom. "And they do it all for show." You know, nice robes, all of that. You know, today, we've kind of seen that, you know, nice suits, nice ties, nice cars, nice homes, even mansions in some cases. But they're not helping their people. They're putting heavy burdens on people. You know, we've seen that. Verse 6, "They love the best places," or the places of honor, "at feasts, the best seats in the synagogues." Yeah, they'll have special seating for themselves. You know, we've seen similar things these days, and I'm not saying that disparagingly. We've just seen that. It's just how it works. Human nature never changes. It doesn't matter whether you're in the priesthood or not. It doesn't change. You know, I have this little scenario kind of run through my head when I think of this, and, you know, I know there might be a hint of sarcasm here, but I'll try to make it. You know, I don't know about you, but sometimes I watch on YouTube these Senate hearings, you know, where they have the senators grilling this panel of whatever they are. They could be people in position. They're usually corrupt as all get out, and they're being grilled by the Senate. Well, I kind of picture this, you know. Here's Paul and Barnabas sitting here. They're questioning some ministers from our background. You know, they watch them arrive, limo service, all of that. 5-star accommodation, probably. He whispers to Barnabas, and he leans over and asks Barnabas, says, "Boy, these guys look really good. They're really nice. What's that they got on?" And Barnabas says, "Well, those are suits. Those are Brooks Brothers tailored suits, about $3,000 a pop. They have a closet full of them." Okay, I'm sorry for that. And Paul also, he whispers to Barnabas, says, "What's this retirement plan I hear him talking about?" "I know, you know. Me and my fellow apostles, our retirement plan was at the end of a sword." Verse 7, so I'll go on here, sorry. "They like greetings in the marketplaces and be called by men, 'Rabbi, Rabbi.' But you do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you're all brethren." Oops, you mean we're all equal in God's sight? How can that be? Doesn't fit our program. Doesn't fit our tradition. So Jesus is saying here that their religion enslaves people. They're the ones that become enriched because of that slavery, that in control over other people. It gives them a position of rule over people, and they use that. Let's go down to verse 13. Jesus goes on and says, "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men." You know, again, what he's telling them, you're not helping people. You're not bringing them to the Father. You're shutting them off. You're shutting them out of God's kingdom, what you're doing. You're putting them into slavery, in other words. But continuing, verse 13, you know, Jesus said, "Shut up the kingdom of heaven." Then he goes on to say, "For you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses and for pretense, make long prayers. Therefore, you will receive greater condemnation. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he's won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves." Again, putting people in slavery leads them nowhere. And the only people that become enriched by that are the ones that practice this impure, this defiled religion. You know, let's turn over to Ezekiel 34. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that these traditions go clear back in history, Israel's history. And it starts with the priesthood. Ezekiel 34. And you got to remember, what it's talking about here in Ezekiel 34 is the forerunner of these guys Jesus was addressing. Ezekiel 34, verses 1 through 10. Again, from the New King James. Where verse 1 says, Ezekiel 34. "And the word of Jehovah came to me, saying, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, Thus says Jehovah to the shepherds, Woe to the shepherds of Israel who feed themselves. Shouldn't the shepherds feed the flocks? You eat the fat and clothe yourself with the wool. You slaughter the fatlings, but you do not feed the flock." They're talking, they take all the bounty, all the good stuff. They use it for themselves and let the sheep become skinny, weak, diseased. They don't take care of them. Verse 4, "The weak you have not strengthened, nor have you healed those who were sick, nor bound up the broken, nor brought back what was driven away, nor sought what was lost, but with force and cruelty." Traditions, "you have ruled," you can say dominated them. So this characteristic of a false religion is about dominating, controlling people, aggrandizing the leadership. Verse 5, "So they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and they became food for all the beasts of the field when they were scattered. My sheep wandered through all the mountains and on every high hill through all the nations. Yes, my flock was scattered over the whole face of the earth, and no one was seeking or searching for them. Therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of Jehovah. As I live, says Jehovah, surely my flock became prey, and my flock became food for every beast of the field because there was no shepherd. Nor did my shepherds search for my flock, but the shepherds fed themselves and did not feed my flock," took care of themselves, their first priority. "Therefore, O shepherd," verse 9, "hear the word of Jehovah. Thus says Jehovah, behold, I am against the shepherds, and I will require my flock at their hand. I will cause them to cease feeding the sheep, and the shepherds shall feed themselves no more. For I will deliver my flock from their mouths, that they may no longer be food for them." So just kind of paraphrasing the first two points there. We don't serve traditions. And we have to remember that the, you know, pure religion, which we see in a moment, frees people, but an impure religion enslaves people. But the third characteristic of an impure religion is it's a religion of outward righteousness, of outward righteousness. Let's turn over to Matthew 23 again. No, we were there earlier. Again, New King James. We'll drop down further in the chapter to read verses 22 through 35. Matthew 23, verse beginning in verse 22. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law. I don't know if you've ever looked those up, you know, mint, anise, and cumin. They're really tiny little seeds. That's what they are. They're little spices. Tiny. And the Pharisees were counting these out, showing everybody, boy, they really knew how to tithe. They were bragging about it. You know, early on when I came into the church, there was a bunch of guys sitting around, and one individual started bragging about how much he gave to the church. And you know, even then, as naive as I was and green behind the ears, I thought, well, you know, that you shouldn't do that. That's something personal, like prayers between you and God. But that's what he was doing. But the Pharisees, you got to get a little picture here, a little image. They're counting out these little seeds. They're like laying them on a table, and they're 10 seeds, and they say 9 for me, 1 for God. And they keep doing it. Boy, it really looks pious. They think it really looks pious. It looks like they're really religious doing that. But Jesus, what did Jesus tell them? He says, you're forgetting the weightier matters, the judgment, the justice, mercy, and faith. And he said those ought to be done. He's not condemning tithing at all, just the way they were doing it. What they were doing was a mockery of tithing. But going on in verse 24, he said, blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. They focus on those tiny little seeds, but they ignore the much bigger spiritual things. Verse 25, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they're full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, again, an outward righteousness, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Talk about a scathing criticism. You know, I kind of have an example from my past that relates to this. Back when I actually worked for a living, we broke for lunch, and one of my coworkers, he loved these, you know, these little tins of sardines. It has the pull tab or maybe the little key where you wind up. And he loved those. He had every lunch he'd have one of those. And he'd grab one out of there, pop it into his mouth. Just loved those things. And one day he did that. He pulled the lid off of it and popped one in his mouth. And about time I said, what's that smell? He vomited. They were rotten. They were bad. Boy, they stunk to high heaven, let me tell you. I don't know if he ever ate any again. You know, I know that's an awful story. But the point here is that can of sardines looked really good on the outside, but inside it was rotten. That's what Jesus is telling these Pharisees. He says, you look good on the outside, but you're rotten on the inside, rotten to the core. Verse 28. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside, you're full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. And what's that lawlessness? Well, that's their traditions. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, you know, think Ezekiel 34 there, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophet. Oh, yeah, you would have. Therefore, you are witnesses against yourselves that you are the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt. He's saying you're going to get what you deserve. Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell? So again, I'll just briefly cover those 3 points on an impure religion. And the first one was an impure, defiled religion serves tradition and not people. And number two, an impure religion is about enslaving people, keep them in their religious system, which under all those traditions. Point three, it's about outward righteousness. Nothing on the inside. It's all about looking good. It's all about appearances. So just taking a look at those, then what are the characteristics of a pure religion? Well, obviously, they're just the opposite. 3 points again of a pure religion. And the first point is, a pure religion serves people and not tradition. Serves people and not tradition. If you would, turn over to Luke 14. Luke 14, again from the New King James, beginning in verse 1, going down to verse 11. You know, we've already read some of the traditions of the Pharisees had about the Sabbath and how it must be kept according to them, according to their condition. But in verse 1 of Luke 14, now it happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath, Sabbath context, that they watched him closely. They were bird-dogging him, as we would say. They wanted to accuse him of something. Does that kind of sound like Trump? No, I'm not comparing Jesus to Trump at all. I'm just, you know, kind of like that, kind of the same thing. And behold, verse 2, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus, answering, spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? You know, that seemed like a reasonable question to us, but, you know, to that was an astounding question to them. They didn't understand that at all. That's outside their tradition. You can't do that. That was a perplexing question. You know, it kind of had them baffled. It didn't fit with their straitjacket tradition. It just didn't. So, verse 4, they kept silent. And he took him, the man who had dropsy, and let him go. Then he answered to them, saying, which of you, having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit, will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath? And they could not answer him regarding those things. You know, it seems incredible to us that somebody let someone die, not even lift a finger to help someone because it was Sabbath tradition. You know, we could even look at that today. You know, if say there's someone in a hospital or in a nursing home that you could visit today, you know, to help them, or even animals that are having problems that you need to take care of, you know, maybe you should do that on the Sabbath. Maybe you shouldn't even be here in church. And that's a rare occasion, of course. But, you know, we've done that sort before. You know, sometimes the Sabbath just doesn't go the way we plan. You know, things come up and we respond to that. But sometimes you just miss services because of that. And that's perfectly understandable. It's okay. It's all right to go out of your way to help someone on the Sabbath, to save a life on the Sabbath. What would you do? I can't tell you how many times we, 52 years, I don't know how many, and we've always traveled a lot. One time I was traveling 165 miles each way, and just come across accidents. You know, at one time I was a trained first responder. You know, I know how to deal with bleeding, breathing problems, and all that. Not move people and all that. You know, you can save a life just by doing a couple things right. Another Sabbath story from history. And then, again, I heard this story early on, and you know, I'm not super intelligent, but you know, I can tell when things shouldn't really be said, you know, and it's not really bragging, but I remember this individual on the Sabbath, one of his neighbors came over and wanted to borrow a ladder. He needed to get up in his roof or something. I don't know, maybe it's leaking, I don't know, something like that. And this church member, I'm not gonna let you borrow my ladder. It's the Sabbath. That's work if I go get that ladder for you. Yeah. People did that back in those days. You know, I couldn't even tell the poor guy, my ladder's out alongside the garage, help yourself. Didn't even do that. But he was quite proud of that. He didn't do any work on the Sabbath. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, many similar situations. Sometimes there's just sick people or someone, a widow or someone that needs a hand. Sometimes there's animals, again, that need taken care of. So the point is, we have to remember, pure religion does not serve tradition. It doesn't serve traditional taboos. It serves people. The second point under pure religion, a pure religion frees people. It doesn't enslave them. It's a benefit to them. A pure religion is a benefit to people. It doesn't enslave them. Let's turn over to Luke 13, if you will. Luke 13, I'm going to be reading verse 10 through 16. Again, New King James. Again, Sabbath context. Learn a lot, can't we, just by reviewing these these accounts that occur on the Sabbath. And, you know, when you think about it, Jesus taught a whole lot about that, didn't he? A lot. Luke 13, beginning in verse 10. Now he was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. It was his custom to go to the synagogue on the Sabbath. It wasn't Sunday. It's on the Sabbath. And behold, there was a woman who had a spirit of infirmity 18 years and was bent over and could in no way raise herself up. I have no idea what the commentators would say about that, but it must be some kind of a spinal issue if you couldn't stand up straight. Yeah. Verse 12, but when Jesus saw her, he had compassion on her. When he saw her, he called her to him and said to her, woman, you're loosed. You're freed from your infirmity, he's saying. You're free from your sickness. You know, Jesus was always about him freeing people, not enslaving them, always. He never did that. Verse 13, and he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight and glorified God. Can you imagine 18 years? Maybe the pain left her first time in 18 years. You got to add all that up every day, every hour, every minute. She was probably in pain. Verse 14, what happened? Uh-oh. But the ruler of the synagogue answered with indignation. He's highly offended. He was brimming over with this self-righteous indignation here. Because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, and he said to the crowd, he's going to straighten the crowd out. He's going to put Jesus down, he thinks. There are 6 days in which men ought to work. Therefore, come and be healed on them. Not on the Sabbath day. Can't do that. Verse 15, the Lord then said to him and answered him and said, you hypocrite, does not each one of you on the Sabbath loose his ox or donkey from the stall and lead it away to water? You know, I always thought it was interesting. He throws back in their face an animal, an example of reference, saying you'd help an animal, but you wouldn't even help a fellow human being. That's what he's telling you. He's shaming that is what he's doing. Verse 16. So ought not this woman, being a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan has bound, you know, think of that, for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath? And when he said these things, all of his adversaries were put to shame. Hopefully they slunk off with a tail between their legs. But continuing verse 17, and all the multitude rejoiced for all the glorious things that were done by him. And again, a pure religion is about freeing people, making life easier for them, not imposing things on them. You know, remember the Pharisees, they laid heavy burdens on men's shoulders, what they did. They weighed them down with their layers and layers of tradition. You know, Jesus always wanted to lift people up. You know, all of us from time to time find ourselves needing lifted up, don't we? Let's turn back over to Ezekiel 34. When we were there in Ezekiel 34 before, we covered the bad sheep. Now we're going to look at the bad shepherd. Now we're going to look at the good shepherd, the right shepherd. Ezekiel 34, let's go down to verse 11. Ezekiel 34, verse 11. I'm going to read this one from the NLT. And again, we looked at the bad side. Now we're going to look at the good side of shepherding. Ezekiel 34, verse 11. For this is what the sovereign Jehovah says. I myself will search and find my sheep. He's going to make a contrast here. I will be like a shepherd looking for his scattered flock. I will find my sheep and rescue them from all the places where they were scattered on that dark and cloudy day. That could be about any time in church history. Verse 13, I will bring them back home to their own land of Israel from among the peoples and nations. I will feed them on the mountains of Israel and by the rivers and in all the places where people live. You know, I lead that. You know, he's speaking. If you look at the context here, he's speaking in terms of the future. It's prophetic. In any age, this is the kind of shepherd he is. And remember, always have to remember, Ezekiel is written in vision. It's futuristic. If you read the whole thing. And I'll have to admit, there's some parts of Ezekiel I don't really understand. Verse 14, where it goes on to say, yes, Jehovah's saying, I will give them good pasture on the high hills of Israel. There they will lie down in pleasant places and feed in the lush pastures of the hills. I myself will tend my sheep and give them a place to lie down in peace, says the sovereign Jehovah. I will search for my lost ones who strayed away, and I will bring them safely home again. I will bandage the injured and strengthen the weak, but I will destroy those who are fat and powerful. I will feed them, yes, feed them justice, you know, give them pretty much what they deserve. And we've seen a little bit of that already with that impure, defile religion and the folks that practice that. Verse 17, and as for you, my flock, this is what the sovereign Jehovah says to his people. I will judge between one animal of the flock and another, separating the sheep from the goats. That's a different reference, but verse 18. And then he goes on to say, is it enough for you, and he's addressing the priesthood, to keep the best of the pastures for yourself? You know, there were provisions. You can read that in the, you know, when the priesthood was first established, there were provisions for them. You know, they would basically serve like an apprenticeship from 20 to 30. Then they would practice as a priest until they were 50, and then they would be given a spot of land. They were taken care of. There were provisions for them. But he goes on to say, must you also, and they deviated from what they were supposed to do, must you also trample down the rest? Isn't it enough for you to drink clear water for yourself? Must you also muddy the rest with your feet? And again, it's speaking about all the things that enrich them. Why must my flock eat what you have trampled down and drink water you have fouled? Therefore, this is what the sovereign Jehovah says, I will surely judge between the fat sheep and the scrawny sheep, making a comparison there. For you fat sheep pushed and butted and crowded my sick and hungry flock until you scatter them to distant land. In other words, you starve them. You literally push them away. You shut them out, as we saw earlier, from observing God's rules, his commandments, and obeying him. Verse 22. So I will rescue my flock, and they will no longer be abused. I will judge between one animal of the flock and another, one sheep and another. And here's a very prophetic statement. And I will set over them one shepherd, my servant David. That will be his position, we know, in God's kingdom. He will feed them and be a shepherd to them. And I, Jehovah, will be their God. And my servant David will be a prince among my people. I, Jehovah, have spoken. I will make a covenant of peace with my people and drive away the dangerous animals from the land. Then they will be able to camp safely in the wildest places and sleep in the woods without fear. He says he will protect them. I will bless my people in their homes around my holy hill. And in the proper season, I will send the showers they need. There will be showers of blessing, blessing upon blessings. The orchards and fields of my people will yield bumper crops, and everyone will live in safety. When I have broken their chains of slavery, there it is, and rescued them from those who enslaved them, then they will know that I am Jehovah. They will no longer be prey for other nations, and wild animals will no longer devour them. You know, when I read that, I always think of John 10, where Jesus talks about the beast, the wolves and sheep's clothing. They will live safely in peace, finishing verse 28, and no one will frighten them. And I will make their land famous for its crops, so my people will never again suffer from famines or the insults of foreign nations. In this way, verse 30, They will know that I, Jehovah their God, am with them, and they will know that they, the people of Israel, are my people, says the sovereign Jehovah. You are my flock, the sheep of my pasture. You are my people, and I am your God. I, the sovereign Jehovah, have spoken. Let's turn over to John 10, because that's a perfect fit here when it's talking about good shepherds. John 10. It's a perfect fit because the Father and the Son are the same. They're always the same. Always have been, are now, and always will be. John 10. I don't know about you, that's one of my favorite passages. New King James, John 10, 11 through 15. Jesus said, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep, but a hireling, someone that's not a shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep. His main interest is his own hide, and flees, and the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he is a hireling and does not care about the sheep. Sheep are not his priority. His priority is himself first. Verse 14, I am the good shepherd, and I know my sheep, and am known by my own. As the Father knows me, even so I know the Father. Again, they're the same, always. And lay down my life for the sheep. That's what the good Father does. The good shepherd, the Father and the Son. He cares for his sheep. Good shepherd, he delivers, he frees his sheep. He provides the best for his sheep, like we just saw, both back then and now and in the future. He protects his sheep. Okay, the last point. Point number three under a pure religion. Pure religion is righteousness on the inside, not the outside, as we saw before in the impure. Pure religion is righteousness on the inside, not just the exterior, not for show, not to make a good impression on people. It's righteousness from the inside, the right motivation, the right heart. Not like the Pharisees who had their exterior religion, but they had a rotten interior, a rotten core. And it all comes down to the question, what does all this mean to us? Like turn over 1 John. What's this whole idea? You know, we've been contrasting the difference. Of course, we want the pure side, but what does it mean to us? First John chapter 5, verse 18. New King James, where it says, verse 18, 1 John 5, we know that whoever is born of God does not sin, but he who has been born of God keeps himself, and the wicked one does not touch him. Other words, whatever you're practicing for your religion, your personal relationship with God. And if we're practicing a pure religion, we're not going to sin. We're going to do our best not to. We want to follow what God says in all of our ways. You know, there's a whole lot to be said for pure religion. It's the best of the two kinds that we looked at today. Because, just a brief review, a pure religion does not serve a ceremonial tradition. It does not enslave people. A pure religion serves people. It frees people. And a pure religion is from the inside out. It's more than an outward appearance. And again, I'd like to turn back over to James chapter 1. Just reread a couple of verses we started with in closing here. Because this applies in all ages, in all times, for God's people, for us, brethren. James 1, New King James, verses 26 and 27 again. And think, you know, the difference between, looked at the difference between the pure and the impure, the pure and the defiled. Think of that here. If anyone among you thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, this one's religion is useless. pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, and we want this, to visit the orphans and widows in their trouble, in other words, to serve people, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. That's pure religion. Short.